This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. This episode is a little bit different because we are a three. We don't often do interviews in threes, but both Kate and I really wanted to be part of this discussion. Hi, Kate.
Hello.
We are also here with author Fiona Murphy. Hi, Fiona.
Hey.
Fiona Murphy is an award-winning deaf poet and essayist based in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales. Her work has appeared in Kill Your Darlings, Overland, Griffith Review and The Big Issue, among other publications. Her debut memoir, The Shape of Sound, was released by Text Publishing in March 2021.
It is a beautiful book. Kate is holding it up.
And I've already got lots of marks on mine because I scribbled all over it. I'm sorry, Fee, but it's an act of love, not one of anything else.
Now, this chat is kind of timely. It's something that came about from something Kate and I mentioned a couple of episodes back, where we were giving advice as to privileged able-bodied cis white women to an audience that's not necessarily that. Kate, do you want to talk about the specifics?
I do want to talk about the specifics. So everyone knows that I got back from Margaret River Writers Festival a little hyper and excited, and I got on my high horse. And I was really annoyed at the fact that some, big ticket authors didn't seem to be doing the same amount of face-to-face work as other authors. And I got upset and I said that if you get invited to festivals that you're privileged and you should turn up to everything. And I did do a slight acknowledgement of anxiety and introversion, but I didn't do any more than that. That is what I said.
And then Fee, you wrote to us. What did you say?
Yeah, I sent probably a wordy email, but I love talking about these things because I think it was such a great topic. And I completely agree, being self-important is not ideal. But I think the idea of being a good literary citizen came up. And I think that's something that should be talked about with a little bit of nuance, particularly around festivals and accessibility. And I just come off of an experience of my own of Sydney Writers Festival, which I absolutely loved. But I found it really striking that you have this real buzz coming out of Margaret River. And I was as flat as a tack after the Sydney Writers Festival, not because I didn't enjoy it, but because it was physically and mentally overwhelming as a deaf person to kind of navigate those spaces. And some of the examples that you listed of attending the opening night, closing night and things like that just was physically out of my reach. And I just found it really a little bit concerning if we're talking about what it means to be an active and engaged writer, because it is such a privilege. It's such an amazing industry. But if we're talking about those things, we should consider and acknowledge that access is an issue and it's an ongoing issue and it can be a really different experience if you're a disabled writer.
Great points. Your email was such a good email. I think we were both cringing. Kate, thoughts?
More than cringing. I was mortified, but I was mortified that I had said something that was clearly so ableist and I hadn't even thought about it. So those were the two things. I was utterly overwhelmed by the generosity Fee that you showed in sending an email, which was incredible, and also because that had taken you time and labour and you're a fan of the show, and so that was kind of incredible. There's actually a spot in your book, I was just saying about things that I underlined, and there's one in particular that when I read it, I was like, huh, this is exactly Fee at Sydney Writers Festival. This is exactly what she's talking about. So I just want to read it out if that's okay. It's a bit where you're talking about the overlooking of disabled bodies, and you write, others with able bodies experience the world in seamless ways, entering and exiting buildings without friction or calculation, because parks and schools and workplaces and homes and even our Parliament House have been designed for their bodies only. And when I read that, I was like, Fee told me, and I knew that I had said something that was ableist, but when I read that, I was like, you're absolutely showing me how privileged I am normally walking into those opening nights and all the other things that mean that that is a seamless experience for me. So the combination of your email and reading your incredible book, which we will get to talking about in a minute, has been so incredible, which is why we wanted to get you on partly. Catherine, your response, because I know you wanted to add something.
Was very similar. It is a great example of ableism. And it's one of those things, once it's pointed out, it seems very self-evident. Something that it made me reflect on at a bit of a tangent, and I can't remember where I read this, was that when people make mistakes, there's a real tendency to call them out publicly. So there's kind of a shaming element to criticism at times. And this article was saying that a counter to that is to call people in and to have an intimate conversation with them. And this was a really nice example of calling people in. And having said that, I think there's a place for both. There is absolutely a place for calling people out and for calling people in.
Fee, do you have to do it a lot?
Yeah.
I do, but it's something that I find easier if I'm advocating for other people. And I think that's something that we do in the disability community is we look out for each other constantly. So when I'm asking about access, I generally don't ask always for myself, but I'm asking for general access because it is exhausting and it is this level of vulnerability when you are asking for yourself all the time, because you kind of, particularly if you have an invisible disability, of that sort of questioning and sort of, is she really putting it on? Is that real? Is that not? And that does come out quite subtly through how people engage with you. But I really like the idea of calling out and calling in as well, because I think they both have a really important part in creating change. Because I have been ableist for most of my life. Like all of the stuff that I've learned by being an active member of the disability community. And I didn't realize that I could have access requests until I saw other proud, strong, disabled people say, no, you can ask for equality. You're like worth every other human. Mm. You can ask to be included. And it is a real skill asking about access and inclusion, which is something that we'll talk about soon of how to gain these skills. But I think it should be said, I've definitely been really ableist and it's something that I'm working on improving and learning about, because I don't think that it's about getting it right and wrong. I think it's a journey and kind of accruing information and having an awareness that everyone's experience of the world is totally different.
Mm-hmm. It's such a good example when you said then about how you don't normally advocate for yourself. And in fact, when you sent that email, it was our request to interview you because you actually sent it with like a list of 30 other people who we could interview. and we will, we might put a link with some of those names in there as well. But you also linked to what you've been working on, which is a toolkit with Writers Victoria. And it's so terrific. I've just been, we've been looking at it. I know one of the things that I'm aware we need to do better for the podcast straight away looking at it, and Catherine and I talked about this, is asking for access requirements for people that we're interviewing, and also which we've known for a while, is that we need to do better accessible social media. And so you've just got really clear kinds of points in that toolkit. Who is the toolkit for and how do you want people to use it?
So it was a project done in collaboration with Arts Access Victoria, Writers Vic, along with Jackie Brown and Phoebe Nelson. And we got some really great funding off the back of doing some disability equality workshops specifically for the publishing industry. So Writers Vic and Arts Access have done a huge amount of work to try and steer a lot of change. So initially the toolkit was targeted towards, say, people working in the industry, so editors, publishers, people in marketing, publicity, but it is quite pertinent for authors as well, or anyone who considers themselves to be a literary citizen, such as booksellers or even readers. And we tried to make the toolkit as accessible as possible by putting kind of questions throughout the toolkit. So if you have a question around language, for instance, of like, should I use this or should I use this? We try to break it down to give really kind of straightforward answers around the sort of do's and don'ts and kind of unpacking what ableist language is and euphemisms and slurs. And I think as writers, we do sort of get caught up in what's the right word? What is the one word I should use? And really, one of the take-home messages is just ask the individual you're engaging with, how do you wish to identify? Because there's a whole host of different ways somebody may choose to identify, and you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to try and guess. I think where people make a lot of mistakes around access and inclusion is that they try and do all the guesswork when really it's not rude to ask someone, do you have any access requirements? How do you choose to identify? They're actually really welcomed and engaged questions. It's not rude. It's just showing that you care and you want to be, want to work with that person.
Mm. Takes a lot of the worry out of it too, doesn't it? Like it's such simple stuff.
Absolutely. Because I think a lot of the reason why people don't ask these questions is because a lot of us grew up being told that it's rude to kind of look, it's rude to stare, it's rude to consider different bodies as being different. When really, as a disabled individual, it's taken a lot of kind of courage to talk about being different, because that's always been considered like a taboo subject to talk about. Whereas the one thing, the toolkit, is really just trying to give people practical skills that they can be a part of a positive change for good. And it's not about having millions of dollars to improve access. Sure, that would be great, but it's how to be a good human to other humans. And even kind of really basic things of being a good digital citizen, of having captions for your videos, image descriptions is a really quick and easy way of being more inclusive. And things like avoiding all caps or strange fonts and things like that in tweets. Suddenly makes the internet more accessible and engaging, and you're being a really great citizen.
Those examples are so terrific. I saw, I can't remember who shared it now last week, just about on Instagram about the color of your font and using white against black. It could have been Carly Finlay or black against white. And I was like, ah, I totally didn't know that. And I've really tried to shift that really quickly, because that wasn't such an easy thing for me to do. That's not even a one that I have to think about how I'm going to make a plan to enact that one. That was just so simple.
All right, Fee, let's get to the juice of it. We really want to talk about your book. The Shape of Sound is a memoir about you keeping your deafness a secret for more than 20 years. It is incredible. I read it in a day, which I note puts me in the same camp as Helen Garner on the front cover, a huge endorsement. If that's not enough for listeners, I don't know what is. You talk a little bit about this in the book, but where for you did the writing of it begin?
It began in a really sort of haphazard way. So I'd moved to Melbourne in 2015. I was sort of aimlessly doing things, a little bit lost in a new city, and I had heard about RMIT and the writing course, which I know you've both been enrolled in. And I kind of ended up doing a few of their short courses, and I broke my wrist. I was sort of at a loose end of kind of a lot of self-pity, to be fair. And I ended up enrolling in the RMIT PWE course, the professional writing and editing course, is kind of like just having this fun outlet where I wasn't kind of worrying and fretting about this career-changing injury that I acquired because I had been working as a physio. And it was really during that course, I thought I was just going to go in, churn out a novel as you do, kind of go on my way. And it was only when I started to write that all these little bits of fragments of my experience trialing hearing aids a few years earlier just really started coming out of me, not in an easy, simple way. It was more like pulling teeth. It was absolutely horrible. But I just kept fixating on this experience and trying to understand it. And it wasn't smooth, clean, beautiful writing by any means, but it was a writing that I really obsessed with. And eventually, over many months, I kind of shaped it into something, and I kind of submitted it to a literary journal, and I didn't want to think about it anymore because I'd taken so much heart to even get like 1500 words together. Like, it took thousands of words to get to those 1500 words. And I was like, yeah, I've done the deafness thing. I've written about it. Cool. Moving on to this, like, churning out a novel. And like, it got picked up and people started to find out that I was deaf. And that was really confronting within itself in a huge, huge way. And I started to realize that this wasn't a little topic for me that could be done and dusted in a personal essay. It was something more complex and more unnerving and life-altering than I ever anticipated. And it kind of started to slowly, I wouldn't say snowball from there, but it was something that I continued to return to again and again.
I mean, this is really at the heart of the book, this extraordinary kind of secret that you keep, because it seems an amazing thing to be able to do. What impacts did that have on you, keeping your deafness a secret?
I didn't really recognize the impacts until I started to let the secret go, because it was so innate into everything that I did, for anything from how I engaged with other people to how I scheduled my life to how I like approached things. It was very much kind of being on the front foot as much as possible. So in conversations, even if it was one-on-one, I would always think of ways of asking questions to make sure that I heard things correctly. So if I wasn't sure, I wouldn't ask people, can you repeat that? Or pardon me, what did you say? I avoided all those kind of key telling phrases of mishearing, and I would rephrase and I would say things like, how so? Interesting. Can you expand on that?
Oh, wow.
How would you do that differently? And it would really, I found kind of ways of maneuvering with language to try and get people to fill in the gaps that I was missing. So I became quite flexible in conversations. But then say, for example, in jobs and things like that, I'm just quite a flexible, movable person. So I would maneuver myself and kind of alter my body to kind of catch words. So I would be very much kind of training my ear to follow conversations, but I had to learn how to hide all of this as well. So it was kind of secrets upon secrets upon secrets to kind of keep this big secret that I had, that I didn't even realize the extent of it until I started to write about it. And then I was like, holy hell, these are a lot of little habits, and this is really exhausting, and I'm so very tired hiding this. But it's been a process to let go of some of those habits, because I still very much present as somebody, I believe in most situations, as somebody effortlessly engaging, and I very much still hide the fatigue.
So writing was one, sounds like it was one turning point in how you thought about being deaf. Can you think of others?
Definitely when I tried hearing aids when I was in my mid-20s, that was a real shock, because I thought I understood what sound and silence was. I thought I understood the very nature and texture of what hearing is for people who have two functioning ears. I thought, how boring, like, what are two functioning ears? I have one functioning ear. This is great. But when I tried on this specific set of hearing aids, it replicated the experience of having two functioning ears. And the binaural summation that happens. So it's very much both sides of the brain suddenly have the capability of communicating with one another. It created a 3D experience of sound, which I hadn't realized I was experiencing the world with, kind of a almost 2D flat compressed experience of sound. Suddenly the world just shot up and out and expanded, and just, I vividly remember walking up the street with the hearing aids in and hearing this skateboard, and I could hear it from like 700 meters away. It was just obscenely far away, of just being like, oh God, what an awful sound. I can understand why like people hate skateboarders. I was just like beside myself thinking, get off that skateboard. It is horrific. So my very neural map of the world, let alone my own body, just shifted within minutes. And I lost my the center of self. So I became dizzy and unsteady on my feet. I didn't know how to engage with other people because suddenly I had access to the whole other space that I suddenly started to realize the way I was living before was quite different to most people, and the amount of effort to bridge the gap was ongoing and extremely physical.
One of the extraordinary things about reading the book is your capacity to put your reader in that headspace and to be able to understand like some of those things, even when you're saying, you know, neural and all these kind of brain things, it seems like really dense kind of medical language that we might not understand, but your capacity to put us in the physical space and understand sound and silence was just, I kept on reading bits out to my husband, who's a nurse. I was like, oh my God, did you know about this? So I just wanted to jump in there to say that.
The book is a real education. There are a lot of very striking moments, I think, and you've mentioned this a little already, where you reflect on historic attitudes or prevailing attitudes to being deaf and how you've internalized them. So sign language and learning Auslan is one example. How has signing been viewed historically, and what has it meant to you to learn it?
So historically, it's only very recently that it's even been considered a language. And that was in the 1960s. A linguist actually stopped and studied sign language and really put together a framework that, yes, it's got syntax and grammar and it's a whole complete language. And there's hundreds of sign languages around the world. There's this real misconception that there's only one sign language. But
which is cool. Like, you have sections in the book where you sort of talk about the origin of words in different, in even between New South Wales and Victoria, that words are spoken, signed differently.
There is such fascinating information about Auslan, Australian Sign Language, that I'm just like so eager for people to recognise that we have so many different languages in Australia, including Indigenous sign languages. And there's just an amazing amount of information, but still, even now, so historically it was considered to be quite primal, animalistic, just a series of meaningless gestures. And that idea of being deaf and dumb really came from that, because spoken words were considered to be a sign of intellectual capability. So if you could speak and speak well, clearly your brain was working and functioning. If you couldn't speak or couldn't speak well, at that time, you were considered to be inferior or even subhuman. So there's a real legacy in history of deaf people being not quite human and not quite there because they weren't able to communicate in the same way or with the same ease of people who have access to spoken language. And that is an ongoing legacy and has ongoing impacts. And it's really evident with how people with hearing loss are still treated with hearing technology and they're unsupported with linguistic capabilities and sign language. So it's still very much, let's try and get deaf people to become hearing people and they'll be fine and they'll cope. But when really it's just as exhausting when you have hearing technology, because you're still having to bridge that gap of communication. And that's something that I was hoping to explore a little bit in the book, is not saying that one is better than the other, but really that it's complex and people can't be fixed. They are people with experiences. And I kind of wish that I had access to Auslan when I was growing up, because I definitely have experienced language deprivation as a result of not having that full access to language, which is kind of shown up in my writing style, in how I construct sentences and how words still slip out of my sentences on the page. And there's something I hope over time, when I was starting with writing, I was very embarrassed about and mortified, but now I just want my writing to become deafer and deafer on the page, because I think it's a different approach to language that is no lesser, it's different. And I think a lot of deaf narratives, there are more deaf writers being published, and I think that deaf style of writing is something that hopefully is more available.
And so you have been learning Auslan for how long now?
So I've been learning it for the last 3.5 years. I'm still terrible, terrible. Like, I do the classic thing of getting very excited and making signs up, which a lot of people do, where they're like, I'm going to fill up the space with making up gestures. And I've had many Auslan instructors just say, please don't.
Well, it's such visually, it's such an expressive language. The school that I went to had, from grade 5 to year 12, had signing interpreters in every class. And all the assemblies and all the rest were signed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was amazing. But it's super expressive. Like, in a boring assembly, to be watching someone sign it is extraordinary. Like, it's a cool thing.
That's something I've definitely had to learn to do with my face, because I was so used to keeping my deafness a secret and hiding any effort. Learning to become free and expressive with my face has been really challenging.
So it's tough. Really part of it. Like, the it's very visual.
The descriptions of that are incredible. As when people are reflecting back to you, feet, move your face.
Yes, like, yes.
It's a great way to we can feel you in that moment.
Fee, the book's about deafness, but it actually also provides a real insight to being a physio. You've got a really extraordinary understanding of the body, medically and scientifically, but also based on touch. One of the ways that we see this come out in the book is through your observations on buildings. Can you talk about the relationship you see between buildings and bodies?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I didn't think I would write about at all, being a physio, because, you know, when it's your bread and butter, it's sort of like, ho-hum, how boring is this?
I love that stuff, though. Like, I love that. And people kind of have that. Most people have been to a physio. Like, I love that back door kind of aspect.
And that's kind of how I came around to it in the end, because I started to look at, not only was I looking at deafness with kind of a fresh perspective when it radically changed. When I broke my hand, wrist, and needed the tendon transplant, which was quite, at one point I didn't know if I could return to being a physiotherapist. At that point I was like, why do I even like this job? And it was really that idea of being intimately connected with someone as a form of therapeutic intervention. I really started to think, oh, actually, this is kind of a weird job where you're allowed to kind of, you know, touch people and do things and that sort of thing. But I really started to consider what makes that profession and the caring profession so unique in sort of its aspects of what we do day to day to help other people, but also what it gives us and the sort of knowledge that we have. When I was a young physio, I was extremely ableist. I had this real fixed perception of, yeah, do your exercises, we'll get you going, you'll be super fine. And it was a really narrow way of viewing the body. And it was only as my relationship with my body started to change, I started to recognize that disability is part of life. And some bodies have disabilities that if we change the world, their bodies wouldn't experience barriers or that friction, and they could just seamlessly be involved and equal citizens in all respects. But the way our world is currently set up is generally for the norm or the average body. It's not necessarily the best body, but it's built on kind of what's accessible for most people without any sort of forethought or insight into kind of different ways of accessing buildings and things like that. So it was really, once I started to kind of recognize the disability community and be a part of it, I started to learn about the social model of disability and how we could change the world to be more inclusive.
So you have a great example in there of Winston Churchill. Can you talk a little bit about that and how he designed a space to perhaps suit his own needs?
Yeah. So when I started writing about bodies and buildings, there's this like really key quote that crops up often in sort of architectural discourse about we shape our buildings and afterwards our buildings shape us, which in itself is a stunning quote. Mm. It is just like how he just captured it. But that kind of stayed with me and bothered me, but I couldn't figure out why it was bothering me for a really long time, until months later after reading it. I can vividly remember I was walking through Carlton on my way to the bookstore, just loving a sunny afternoon, and I was like, huh, that's something a disabled person would say. Why would somebody without a disability notice how a body, how a building shapes them? Because the world is built for them. It's not built for somebody with a disability. And the more I started to think about it, I was kind of, the thought just popped into my head. I was like, was he deaf? Because I thought of my own body in buildings and I'm always in the corner or along the wall or kind of working with and against buildings and rooms to kind of hear sounds and hear people and construct and build my way to kind of figure out the best position I can be in to make a conversation work well. And it really sounded like he was doing that work as well. So I went home, did some Googling, and I was like, oh my goodness, holy hell, he was extremely deaf. Amazing. Extremely, extremely deaf when he made that statement, which was in a debate to the Commons Chamber where they did all their parliamentary debates, got completely flattened during the Blitz, and they were having a debate, should they rebuild and change to kind of a horseshoe shape, which was, say, in Washington, where it's a very open space, or should they go back to the original design, which is a very narrow confrontational design where you can literally see your opponent's faces across the room. And he was adamant that they were going to go stick with the traditional design because it was good for democracy, even though there was no real evidence for that at all, because democracy has always flourished in a round. He was like, no, guys, we need to stick with what we know. And it turns out he was extremely deaf, and that sort of setup is ideal for a deaf person. You can see someone across the way, you can lip read them, you can position yourself exactly so that you can pick up all the information. So I found it really striking that this influential, powerful man who had kept his deafness a secret as best he could, he didn't even wear hearing aids in public because they thought it was Russian spyware, that there was a big controversy around that. They kept it, it was a state secret as well, his hearing aids, because they didn't want anyone to find out. And the fact that he, a disabled man, could literally change how parliamentary proceedings are being run in the UK to suit his body is what I believe. I just find striking. And if we had more disabled people in positions of power, maybe we would have a more accessible Parliament House, which has to be retrofitted to allow people with disabilities to even be elected and have positions of power.
It's such a great example. I've got so many questions, but one other example I did want to touch on was the military and people experiencing hearing loss in the military. Can you talk about the significance of that? Because it seems like quite an unusual space.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was Mary Roach wrote a book about what it's like to live in the military, and she was interviewing quite a few people in the military about their experiences, and a lot of people were saying that they really wanted to be deaf, like that was their sort of desire. And the reason why they wanted to be deaf is so that they it was a mark of having experienced active combat and being near active fire. And those troops who were deaf or hard of hearing had obviously been deployed somewhere dangerous, they've survived. And in that space, because so many people have hearing loss, they don't just, people with hearing loss don't just leave the military, but they try and hold on to them and they look after each other as best they can. And they only start to experience the true disabling aspects of being deaf when they go back home and they go back to their families and they start to experience those gaps and frictions in conversations, because there isn't that awareness about good communication strategies with a deaf person. And I just found that absolutely striking. Not that I'm pro-military at all, but the idea that there's a space on this earth where deafness is something that is valued in this strange, weird way, but is also supported so that these people can have jobs and positions and they're included, is something that I just found heartbreaking but hopeful in this strange way.
I find it very hopeful, especially when you, well, hopeful in a way, because you kind of contrast this story, or this contrast exists with your own efforts to look for jobs and what sorts of things you need to disclose and what you don't need to disclose. But it really talks to that idea that anything is really possible. It is a willingness to make it possible, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Final question from me, and then I'll hand over to Kate. This one's on language. I read Eve Reese's memoir last week, which is A Story of Trans Becoming. That's their term. A similarity struck me. Eve's book talks to this idea of gender dysphoria, and that a counter to that is gender euphoria. And your book talks about, rather than losing hearing, this idea of deaf gain. Language is so amazing and empowering and important. Can you talk about your relationship to this idea of deaf gain?
Absolutely. And I'm really, really excited to read Eve's book. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that as a contrast of language. With deaf gain, it's really the concept of coming into a deaf identity. So often it is, hearing loss is associated with this grief and something being taken away from you, that you're lesser than somebody with complete intact hearing. Whereas when you are aware of deafness as a cultural difference and being part of a linguistic minority, it's a totally different way of viewing not only your body, but how you fit into the world as well. For the longest time, I only had the medical definitions of deafness in quite a kind of quantifiable way of, this is how my body is, this is how my body is different. And that sort of language and terminology is really diminishing. And it's also quite a closed way of looking at the body. It's quite kind of a final sort of, yeah, this is your box. Whereas when you look at deafness as something that you gain a language, a community, a culture, a way of having a sense of self-esteem and comfort within your own body, suddenly the world expands and expands, and it's literally boundless how you can be within your body and within the world. And it just completely turns it on its head. And even within myself, of considering myself before I wrote the book and after I wrote the book, I was so closed off to anything, any possibility of change, and really fixated on keeping things as structured and the same as possible in this kind of way of controlling my deafness. Whereas now, just being able to talk about it is just revelatory and exciting, and I'm learning more and more and more as I go along that it's just such a generative place. So it's kind of, yes, I hear less decibels, but now that I have a language that suits my body, a language that I'm not fatigued in when I'm communicating with other people. So I think it's just an exciting way of viewing deafness.
You can totally hear the excitement in your voice, and I can see it in your face because I'm looking at you at the moment. But, and I've also written down in my notes here when you said before, I want my writing to be deafer and deafer on the page. And just the way you said it, like, you can hear that embracing of it as well. I want to switch a little bit to you and your writing process, because we love getting into that. And you talk about it a little bit in the book. The writing is so exquisite, Fee, and it really did remind me of the way Sarah Centilles has structures her books, and I see that she has done a beautiful puff quote for you as well. How did you put those pieces together, the stuff about the body, the stuff about sound, your own narratives? How did you piece them together?
Messily. Really, really messily. That fragmentary approach that I had for that initial essay about hearing aids was something that I've replicated throughout the entire writing process of this book. It hasn't come out in a linear fashion, and I think that's because I haven't understood deafness and my deaf identity in a linear fashion at all. It's very much been an accrual of different pieces of information. But also I think part of my writing process is just understanding how I think about things. And I'm very much somebody who ruminates and circles around an idea for a very long time, first in sort of a large circle, and then I get in closer and closer, and then I go out again. And it's very much kind of moving in and out of an idea. So that's sort of how I write on the page as well, is kind of big overarching kind of brainstorming of what are all these different questions that I have? And then I get in deep with, do I really understand this question? What is this? So it is a process that isn't organized at all, but it's really led by questions more than anything. And the more questions I have about something, the more heat and energy I know that a subject has, and the more I can trust that there's something to write about that. Whereas when I was starting out with writing, I was very much only kind of focused on what I knew as a fact, but I realized that's not really writing. That's just making a list of facts. That's not kind of threading things together and creating sort of an overarching sort of inquiry into something, a topic. That doesn't really answer your question. It was kind of a very mulling away there.
It does, and it reveals so much, because I think that the feeling that you have when you finish the book, Catherine, I don't know if you had this too, was like, there's a master's in here, like more than a, there's a PhD in this book, and I now know all of these other concepts that I just had no idea existed. And you can see how your curiosity has kind of led you in and out of these rabbit holes to all these different places, and to Churchill, and then to, you know, every other thing that you go to. It's extraordinary. I know that you won awards, that you obviously were at RMIT. When you actually sent the book out, how did it happen? How did it get picked up? Where were you when you got the phone call or the email?
I was at work in my office trying to be really cool. So I was kind of like, oh, look out the door to see who's around. And nobody at work knew that I was writing at all. So it was quite this kind of strange series of events of unfolding. And I was just kind of floating around the tea room afterwards. but how I actually got there was a tip from a couple of the tutors at RMIT, very much around have a look at other people's careers and look at their bios, see what they're doing, how they got there. So I kind of was, when I was starting out writing, I looked at kind of my peers or who I thought were people maybe one or two steps ahead of me. And I looked at their bios to see where they were publishing, what they were doing, what they were entering. And I tried to emulate that as much as I could. And then when I got to that level, I looked one or two steps ahead to the next set of bios, and I tried to emulate that and kind of start to build a little for myself.
Because you have a great bio. Like when I was reading it out, I was like, whoa, bang, 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 bang. Like it's so enviable. I think you'll have a horde of people who are going to be copying your bio.
Exactly.
There's no typos in there. Probably there is. But it was pretty much those, because I'm super pragmatic about things. I think that kind of helps from my physio background of like, what's the sort of X, Y, and Z of this? And having that advice of just having small targeted goals was really helpful. So like I was entering like microfiction competitions to start off with. I was like, if I can write 50 words and submit it somewhere, yay for me, I can do this. And then it was 500 words and then 1,000 words, 2,000 words. And it was really starting as small as possible and just having a crack. And then the next smaller thing, the next slightly larger thing, and going up from that. So it wasn't kind of how can I write a book? It was more like, how can I just do the next challenging thing and the next challenging thing. And then along the way, about 2 or 3 years into that process, I started getting emails from people saying, from publishers wanting to know what I was up to and what I was doing. And that was terrifying. It was not that whole, like, these are the emails that you want, because I had heard about that, but it was very much like, oh no,
because you felt pressure?
Yeah. And I still didn't think I was deaf enough to write about deafness. I still had so many identity issues that I was in this strange position. I wouldn't call it an enviable position, because I wouldn't envy myself in it. I was so uncomfortable of really lovely, generous emails of publishers saying, hey, if you have something, send it to us. And me going, oh, I can't even like talk about being deaf, let alone write about it. So I felt like I'd created this scenario of like, oh, I've got all these got runs on the board. I'm doing all the right things. And my goodness, this is really scary. This is terrifying. So what I did next was, I recognized that I needed people to talk to about this who were disabled, because I think I had spoken to a lot of people who were non-disabled, but it was hard to say, look, this is terrifying because of this, this and this. And having those really frank, open conversations about how to navigate the industry is a little bit different when you're talking to disabled people, because it's a different industry when you have a disability. It's changing, but change is slow. Mm-hmm. And I was very lucky to get a couple of fellowships. So I was mentored by Fiona Wright and Jessica White. Fiona Wright has written extensively about her disabilities and experience with disability, and Jessica White is a deaf writer. So to have suddenly a team of people where I could just actually consider what I was doing as a book project made such a difference. And then just kind of work through all those real issues of representation and identity, because I didn't want to get into the situation of cultural appropriation or harming a community that I was only new to. And I took it really seriously. I didn't want to kind of stuff up, and because a book is one thing, but a life is another thing. And I wanted to kind of foster a really good life in this community. So it was really kind of having mentors allowed me to build a project in a way that felt comfortable. Not that it was a comfortable thing to write, but it felt that I was making the decisions of, yes, I'm ready to take it to the next level, and yes, I can do this and do this. How it actually got published was a series of unexpected events that happened rather quickly. So I had entered the next chapter fellowship the first year it was out, and got highly commended. And that really sparked a fire in me of like, well, I'll do better next year. So I like really focused on thinking, yeah, I'm doing a book. This is what I'm going to do. I was quite structured in my approach, as everything I am in life. I'm super structured. And I thought, I'm going to kind of really focus on creating a couple of solid essays. And I used a few competitions as ways of road testing ideas with things of whether they were sticking or not. And I got together some essays, and I got entered the next chapter the second year around it was available. And I got an email from the Wheeler Center, and they're like, you're ready to be published. Like, sorry, we're
no longer eligible.
And I was like, oh no, I really want that money.
I've worked like, all year for this.
Yeah, I was kind of like, oh. But what they said in the email is like, look, you're ready to be published. This is the development prize. But one of the judges has offered to chat to you if you like. And I was like, okay, sure. Don't give me the money, whatever. And one of the judges, the incredible Ben Law, got in touch and was just an absolute gem. And he just talked me through the next steps of like, okay, what should we do to get this published? And I had been in contact with a couple of publishers, but he really just spoke me through the process in a way that was just so genuine and he's just such a heartfelt guy. It just felt comfortable, as opposed to before where it was having to do things on my own was just, I was not up for it. And then within a 2-week period, I had signed with Text and it all just kind of zoom, zoom, zoom. Yeah.
That is an awesome story. That is like really good story.
It's a good, really nice people. Like, it's a sign of like what a good community can be, or people helping people.
It's a sign of that, but it's also a sign of your, exactly as you say, your structure, your plan, your persistence in going, this is what I'm going to do. These are the small steps I need to take. Like, people who are listening to this, do what Fee did. I don't know if you've got her talent, but do what Fee did, because I think that people are still waiting for the romance of, you know, the big deal and all the things that happen. But your pragmatism just, wow. In terms of your day-to-day writing process now, because I'm very much hoping that we're expecting a new book from you sometime soon, how do you get the writing done? Where does it happen? When? How?
I work full-time, so during the week it's very much writing admin. At night is the bulk of it at the moment, still doing publicity and stuff like that. But I aim to do anywhere between 5 to 20 minutes of writing a night, which doesn't sound like much, but it's enough to keep the characters in my head. So I'm writing a novel next and that's just ticking over in my head. I'm just kind to myself now. Like, before I would be very much like, oh, I have to do an hour and a half, but that's not good for a young back or any back. And ended up with a lot of physio injuries from spending too much time at a desk. So I'm just really pragmatic now. Just do even 2 minutes a day is still enough. It's not huge, but it's fine. And then on weekends, I try and have 2 long sessions of about 90 minutes apiece, just to kind of sink into the world, swim around in it, and then come back out. What I tend to do, say if it's a competition or a freelance thing, I give myself as much lead time as possible, because I know that I ruminate and circle around things. So I build that into my process of, I do a brainstorm on my phone and then I ruminate. Say if I've got like a tea break at work, I jot in a few other ideas and I just let my unconscious mind do as much heavy lifting as possible. And then I circle around that, do any sort of reading and just go in and out of an idea. But I'm definitely somebody who, if push comes to shove, I could do it the night before, but I know better writing happens if I have 2 or 3 weeks to circle and then kind of shape together all the fragments at the end. But I just try and be pragmatic.
You've already given us such incredible advice. I've got my pen out taking notes, but we always ask writers to give advice to other writers on this show. So what advice do you have for first-time podcast listeners?
It's a personality quiz. So it's nothing too scientific or anything like that. It's called The 4 Tendencies by Gretchen Rubin. She wrote, I think, The Happiness Project. I think that's what it's called. But it's a quiz that I did a couple of years ago and, oh my goodness, it taught me so much about my personality that it has been instrumental for every section of my life, but particularly writing as well. So what she's done is she's created this framework of personality types, and there's the upholder, the obliger, the questioner, and the rebel. And I'm an upholder. Like, I'm such an upholder. So I'm a personality type where I respond really well in terms of my motivation if I have an external sort of motivator of like a deadline, but I also uphold internal motivation. So knowing myself, if I set really lofty goals, I'm going to be such a punisher to achieve them. So I have to actually be really careful with setting goals of not doing really high word limits or really long writing times, because I'm just going to really burn myself out if I do that. So that's why I kind of do 2 minutes of writing, 20 minutes of writing, because I know that I'm going to uphold that. Whereas if I want to do an hour a night or 2 hours a night, I will also uphold that and I will have no social life and I would be exhausted and not creative. So that's kind of how I've built that into my life, is I pick external goals, I have internal goals. That suits me and my personality. But you could be an obliger and you might just really need those external goals to get you through your manuscript or through whatever obligation it is. Or you might be a questioner, and that's where you might really have to circle around something and really understand the point of doing something before you do it. So you might need to understand, what is the point of this manuscript before you can get going with it? Or you might be a rebel and you might just say no to structure, or you might change your work process every second day or every third day, because who cares about rules? I don't care about rules. I care about rules so much. But the rebel personality might be very kind of fast and loose. So I think the kindest thing to do with your body and brain is just listen to what it's telling you and then just go with it. There's no point in fighting it. Just go with whatever tendencies you are and just kind of maybe put in a few little things along the way, and you can end up writing something that is in the way that suits you.
That is amazing. And we will be putting in the link to the four tendencies, and we will also be doing them to make sure that our process gets better. Before we let you go, Fee, I feel like we could talk to you for 2 hours, but we won't. Before we let you go, can you please recommend to us a favorite book by a debut writer?
I really love Hysteria by Katarina Bryant, who is, she's based in Adelaide. And this is a stunning memoir / historical deep dive into hysteria and her experiences of disability and living in a body that is different, and just grappling with the idea of identity. But the way she does it is through history. And it is just absolutely stunning. There's the ways that she has described how her mind shifts when she has episodes of seizures is just, it's such a gift to kind of have access to different experiences of the world. And I think she's an amazing writer, and I really look forward to reading what she has coming out next.
Talking about gifts and being able to access other people's worlds, Fee, your book is extraordinary. The Shape of Sound is utterly extraordinary, and just we can't recommend it enough. But also, you have been so incredibly generous with us, with your time at the outset when we stuffed up, and then continuing with our conversation today. So thank you so much. Your brain is very, very cool, and I want to steal it.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure talking to both of you. And I think I'm just so excited by the idea of all the conversations that we've had around what it means to be part of this community, because I think it's such a great community and we can all play our part in keeping it great.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.